Hi, everyone, and welcome to Academic Dean, where we connect with passionate college leaders who share their stories and viewpoints of higher education, especially lessons learned along the way. Academic Dean is sponsored by Myers-McRae Executive Search and Consulting. Now, here's your host, Dr. Dave Gercheck.
Hi, everyone. Today, I'd like to welcome Dr. Ron Matthews to our show. Dr. Matthews is the president of Eastern University in St. David's, Pennsylvania. Hi, Ron. Glad to have you on the podcast today.
Thank you. Great to be here. I appreciate it. Looking forward to this time.
So can you talk a little bit about your university and why students select your institution?
Surely. As we begin, I do want to say, since this is an academic vehicle, I want to thank all of those in higher administration who are in college and university work and their boards. These are not easy times. And so the multiplicity of issues and all the difficulties and opportunities, it can be wearying. So please know that I'm here today to just say thank you and to share what's going on at Eastern with the recognition that we're all thinking, rethinking, and hoping for the best. So
Good point. Thanks a lot, Dave.
Yeah. Eastern University was started in 1925 as a seminary by the American Baptist denomination. It evolved over the years. Its liberal arts and science division became what was called Eastern Baptist College. And then in 1972, it became Eastern College, a Baptist institution. And then in 2001, it became Eastern University. At that time, the seminary had separated from the college. They were two independent institutions from 1993 to 2003. 2003, the seminary came back. Candidly, it sounds a little bit like a country western song, you know, the mother gave birth to the child that grew up and adopted the mother. And if we had a dog, it would be a country song. But in any case, it's been an interesting evolution for the school. We've been historically shaped and continue to be so by our mission, which is that we are an intentionally diverse and Christ-centered community that seeks to provide and develop graduates that are shaped who will influence the world through faith, reason, and justice. And the idea of faith, reason, and justice is significant for us because faith is what motivates us in light of the great commandment given by Jesus to love God and to love one another. And then we are a higher institution, a higher ed institution, which means the life of the mind is critical. And hopefully faith and reason propel us into making a difference in people's lives. And that's really where justice comes in, that we are committed to access, to availability, to affordability. And that's consistent with our desire to help change the world for common good. So that would be a quick overview of where we are. In my own role, I came to Eastern in 1992. I came as the chair of the music department and also the executive director of the Fine and Performing Arts Division, which was dance, theater, music, and fine arts. And then in the spring semester of 2018, the board invited me to serve as the president. There was obviously a process of vetting and a voting, but I do want to say it was not a career aspiration for me, but I loved Eastern. I do love Eastern, and it had shaped me in such significant ways that to have this opportunity has been really the most inspiring call of my life.
Yeah, when I was looking at your bio, since you started in 1992, I thought, oh my goodness, there's very few times I get to talk to an academic leader who's been at an institution for so long.
And particularly one who loves the place and really grateful for the opportunity. But, you know, I was in my sweet spot in the arts. I've conducted all over the world. I've performed. It's been such a delightful privilege to be able to be full-time at a university and then also have other opportunities to tour and perform and conduct. But candidly, to be able to have one position that is so multifaceted and so inspiring and so requiring of thought and others, honestly, it was kind of like my role as a conductor. And as a conductor, you work with people, particularly if they're professional orchestras, that everyone plays an instrument better than what you can do with their instrument. And so as a conductor, I don't even touch an instrument, and yet I have to mobilize these highly qualified players to share a vision, to work in time so that we can play together at a performance date with hopefully a transformational, beautiful aesthetic experience. And so that has transferred really into my role here. I'm working with brilliant people who know far more than I do in their areas of accountability and service. And yet I get to work with them in a commonly shared vision. We all want the same thing, and that is human flourishing. And we want Eastern to be its best. And it has to be in time, which is why we do strategic planning and operational budgets and scenario planning. But the bottom line is we work really hard, so hopefully we can get to play together. So,
yeah, you know, I always, anytime I have a guest, I always look all over the internet for you. And I was just tickled pink to listen to you play a piano in one of the videos I found. You were excellent. I was thinking, oh my goodness, I've never had a guest also who can play an instrument as well as you do.
Well, thanks. You know, the fun is that I always used to say I play for a living. But when I got into this role, that stopped. I still play, but now it's a little bit more work.
Yeah. Well, what's new on campus?
Yeah, well, you know, we've been addressing two things. I mean, coming in 2018 in the spring, we had some financial exigency issues to address. And so in order to ensure a balanced operational budget, we had to rightly resource and also resize our community, which was painful. It was not a large layoff, but any layoff in a community like ours is significant. And so it was hard to do that, particularly I've been a long-term faculty member. And so coming into this role and then having to announce shortly thereafter that we were going to have some kind of layoff unless there was a significant change in our sources of income. And so that was the first year. The second year, we did manage to have an operational budget that was balanced and with a little bit of margin. And then we had started a new strategic plan, which was going to move us from stress to stability. That was the goal. And so it was a three-year plan. That first year, we had another, it was a layoff, but it was really a right resourcing to appropriate resources from areas that weren't bringing return onto areas that were promising return. That was, again, difficult, but at least people understood from the very beginning, this was where we were going, why we were going, and hopefully it would put us in a better spot for everyone. And so we worked as ethically as we could, as charitably as we could, but the goal was it was successful. And at that point, we started to see, going into the second year of that plan, a turnaround. And then that third year was a significant accomplishment because we were in a position that was not only stable, but I described it as enhanced stability. We had more than we anticipated. Concurrent with that, of course, we had 2 years of COVID, which we decided to stay open during that time. We were closed as mandated in Pennsylvania for the spring semester, the last half of the spring semester of 2020. But we opened in the fall of 2020 and stayed open for the next year as well. Fortunately, our COVID rate was under 1.5%, and that was significant. The students were somewhat exhausted from the protocols, but they also wanted to be together. So the community, in a sense, solved the problem together, which is a life lesson. And so very grateful for that. At the same time, we started last year a new five-year strategic plan. We wanted to get to a position where we were ensuring everyone was being heard. We increased our diversity, equity, and belonging activities and programming. We just finished a cultural audit to make sure that we were listening well, that we were learning together, loving well, and that in fact, we were addressing the things that could really cripple us if we didn't demonstrate the community that we affirmed we wanted to be. Then at this point, we initiated some online graduate courses. It was in a particular model that we had developed called LifeFlex. These models were designed to address three things online: excellence, accessibility, and affordability. Those three things were critical for us. And we started that during COVID, the first year of COVID, fall of 2020. We offered our first master's program that was fully online with this new LifeFlex mode of delivery. And that was extremely successful. We have two entrance points. They're 7-week courses. And so two in the fall, two in the spring, two in the summer. That gives 6 different points to enter the program. And it's a high-touch online program in that students have access to faculty directly in small cohorts. We have, of course, teaching assistants that help the personal touch. And, you know, that's where we're big enough to be credible and have programs of integrity, but small enough to be personal and relational. It turned out that in that first year, when we started this model of the schedule, the pricing, and the accessibility, what we were hoping would be 10 students each cohort with about 50 or 60 at the end of 1 year, if they pretty much continued, turned out that we were close to 500 students. That was miraculous, candidly, because we had not anticipated the market responding so quickly to this program. So we also had other programs that we've been spinning out, and these are all graduate programs. This year, we started our first LifeFlex undergraduate program. The undergraduate program is the same model. It's materials available online, high-touch engagement with faculty and teaching assistants, and also priced in a way that if you do not have means, this is still doable. The window, candidly, is if you have access to FEA and Pell Grants and you know, through the agency of federal and state, that the whole price will come in at under $10,000. And for a 4-year program to come at that price point, that's pretty accessible to pretty much anyone. And the other thing is, if students don't qualify for any help and they have to pay for it themselves, then it's still under $30,000 for the whole undergraduate experience.
Wow.
It's been really exciting for us to see this growing. We've had online for a long time, but this new model is something that we believe is timely, and it helps address the needs of our constituency, and it's been well received so far.
I was just going to ask, so on this new model, is it still a 15-week semester, or is it shorter? Or
we were using the 7-week model in a conventional semester. So we have essentially opportunities for students to take maybe 1 or 2 courses at a time, but they take 4 overall in a given semester of 15 weeks. And the benefit of that is that for people who would be interested in online education, for them to take 4 courses for a semester would be overwhelming. But to take 1 or 2, depending on how long you want to do the program and what your stage of life is, it offers up opportunity to do the equivalent of a full-time load or to do it part-time at your own pace. So the materials are accessible as a kind of a 24/7 model. And then access to the faculty is based on schedule and any kind of online class time that they would have, if that makes some sense. Yeah.
Okay. Well, you've touched a little bit online, but what other things is the university doing to work with this changing landscape of higher ed?
So I think all schools are dealing with the impact of AI, not only in the sense of how it can also serve, but also how it can dangerously master. And particularly for students who may not be used to a writing culture, AI technology is extremely appealing. So there's some ethical issues, and out of that comes conversations about morality, about personal integrity, also about how technology can be useful in a way that is appropriate. So in the philosophical sense and the moral sense, I think there are opportunities there that we're all taking a part of. I think for us particularly, the only reason to have an on-campus experience is if it's a transformational experience. Right now, at least for schools our size, campus life has to be something that's worthwhile. Otherwise, people will just say, well, vocationally, I can't justify it. So it is, when you are in community, an unbelievable opportunity to have life experiences, to develop friendships and relationships, and to approach living with other people in diversity compassionately. I mean, those are really increasingly important as we look at politics and political discussion and war. We need to think differently and love much better if we're going to be producing people that are going to affect change. And Eastern has been doing that. And so right now on the undergraduate space, we're committed to athletic buildouts. We just started football last year and had our first conference season this year. You know, we only had freshmen and sophomores, but we did pretty well. I was amazed that we won anything or that we even scored. But we have a great coaching staff, and the team has done extremely well considering this was their first season. We also had the opportunity to play at Franklin Field in Philadelphia, which was iconic because a stadium that seats like 40,000 people, which candidly, we did not have in attendance, but it was a great thing for the team to start out playing with such a huge venue. And, you know, the Philadelphia Eagles have played there. They have the Penn Relays there. University of Pennsylvania has their football games there. So it was a good kind of first year, and we're grateful for that. But that's only one of the experiences. We were building out all of our athletic programs, adding some to them. We're committed to building out our facilities, which is a big, big investment for us. And then also the same with performing arts. You know, when you perform together in ensembles, you have to have your personal excellence, but that's in subject to the communal excellence. And that's another life lesson. And so with theater and dance and music, it really has been kind of an exciting time to have all of this aligning at a time when it's in question, is it worthwhile to come to a campus for an undergraduate degree? And so we're putting all of our emphasis in the undergraduate experience with the online experience reserved for non-traditional undergrad, and then for most of our graduate programs. We do have hybrids where we have master's and PhD programs, doctoral programs, where it would be maybe a residence commitment for a week or series of weekends, and then online and hybrid. But we also have online exclusively. So all of that has been helpful for us, and candidly, very grateful for where we are now in our enrollment as opposed to where we were 4 years ago.
What's Eastern doing right now for preparing students for today's workforce?
Yeah, and there's two parts of that question. One is, can they get an entrance job in a career? Secondly, do they have a sense of self-confidence and the stewarding of their education to know how it will apply in multiple careers potentially and for the long run? And so we can do technical things that will get us entrance level jobs. But then when you think of the long range, it's not only technology, but it's strategy, it's flexibility, it's accommodation, it's about reaction and proaction. You know, these are the things that colleges and universities do really, really well. And I don't think they've gotten enough credit for that, to produce individuals who can respond and react in a changing market and a changing culture. So that said, we are committed to the rightful understanding and integration of technology. We are committed to internships, externships, student teaching experiences, summer programs, things that are immersive so that students can get a feel for what it means to develop business culture, language skills, writing skills, some of the basics that really help us in our future work. And then we also have increased and have had for a long time, but have increased the resources for career development and placement, those kinds of things, which candidly for a school like ours, we haven't really thought about it too much for our alumni, but we are now building that out so that we can engage better with our alumni who they're lifelong alumni, and we want to make sure that we are providing services for them as well.
Well, then let me ask a follow-up question. Since you talked about some internships, what other things is Eastern doing to collaborate with local businesses?
Yeah, you know, one of the things that I've done is I've joined some of the local Chamber of Commerce communities so that Eastern is seen in those environments. Eastern is located just outside of Philadelphia, and it's a beautiful campus in the main line of the Philadelphia area. But Philadelphia is so close, and we have all of these cultural and economic resources, museums, businesses, you know, what they call the Silicon Valley. And it's really all of the medical development that's going on here, pharma. So we have really tried to partner with and engage with leaders, thought leaders, as well as getting our students involved. We have many hospital systems. We have a College of Nursing and Health Sciences. We have, you know, seven colleges in the university. So we've really tried to have a broad-based approach. For example, our Honors College is involved in providing resources for both public and classical and private schools. And we have a Master's of Arts in Teaching for the classical model, which has been an alternative development over the past 20, 25 years, as we think, well, what are the ways that children can learn, what best environments to provide? And certainly I'm a product of public schools and benefited from it, but there are others who are interested in private schools and particular modes of teaching in that way. And so we all oftentimes have teachers come to Eastern's 4-hour enrichment programs, just like we are able to put our students out to have student teaching and mentoring opportunities in the classroom. We have a College of Education and Behavioral Sciences, another interesting integration where we've gotten a number of grants looking at the whole picture of a child coming to school during crisis, and what do we have to do as far as behavioral sciences integrating with educational methods. So the pedagogy is integrated and thoughtfully engaged in that way. So candidly, there's no lack of opportunity. What we're finding is we just need to ensure excellent interaction and scheduling to accommodate this while they're, you know, full-time students or at least able to get credit for it in the curricula.
Well, with the here's another question then that's kind of in that same subject matter. With the rise of alternative credentialing, how do you see micro-credentials impacting the future of higher ed?
Yeah, I noticed that some schools are taking their full programs and dividing them up into topical offerings. So you can group them as a micro program where it may not be an accredited degree, but it might be an interest area for someone who says, hey, I got to learn something about business and analytics. And you're not ready to take a whole program, but you might be able to take that course. And you bundle courses together. And at some point, you might have enough to say, hey, I'm only 4 or 5 of these courses away from a master's program or something like that. So I do think with the pressure that's coming, not only financially with universities and colleges, but then also with corporations offering alternative models of certification and credentialing, you know, we all have to think about, well, can we do this? How do we do this? And is it going to meet the need? Personally, you know, our school can't do everything. We're not a big school. But what we can do is we can identify what is our mission, and we can be the best that we can be at our mission. And I think, you know, I used to serve in a local church as a musician and a choral director and organist. And I saw when historic church music started to change and be influenced by popular church music, that there was this loss of credentialing because a lot of the historic or traditionally trained musicians were no longer equipped for pop music, you know, contemporary worship music, whatever language we want to use. And so there was this giant shift, and, you know, liturgically based historic churches would be the support for the traditionally trained musician. But for others, it was essentially garage bands who hopefully shared faith values and could perform well. So, you know, in that sense, a lot of churches tried to respond by saying, oh, if we add a worship band, then we'll grow. And that did not happen. The only churches that grew were these kind of startup, innovative mega churches that were small enough to be responsive in the moment to an emerging demographic. and then say, this is who we are. And it was electric and attractive. But, you know, to think that, oh, well, if we start this program, then we'll grow too. You know, we'll compete with Google. Well, that may or may not happen. I think what helps is the discernment of your mission. If your mission's not applicable, that's another question. But they have the ability and the humility to say, this is what we can do really well, and we can offer it accordingly. I don't know if that's fully answering your question, but that's at least been our approach. I think so many schools, they have missions. The question is, how do demographics get impacted by that mission? And does the mission have to be marketed better? Does it have to be adapted in some way to be applicable for this time? You know, we don't have I think about the patience of emerging adults, and they've been shaped by the smartphone, which is instantaneous. It's immediate. If they're moved to give money, they'll give it right away. But if you talk about like a monthly commitment, and it's like, I'm not there yet, you know? So I think that's the same thing with education. There's not this sense of elitism about education. Now it's like, if I want to learn something, I'll go wherever I have to go to get it. And in that sense, that's the great democratization of education, but it's also a threat in some ways. So we have to ask a lot of humble questions and listen well to make sure that we're responding in a timely way and innovating in a timely way.
Yeah, I like your point. You can't be everything to everybody. I think that's really, honestly, a great answer. How is Eastern incorporating community service and civic engagement into your educational process?
There are two ways. One is external, one is internal. We bring in a lot of speakers. We have the Campolo Scholars Center of Ministry, which brings in practical activists and advocates who can shape the conversation based upon their experience. We have a number of illustrious alumni. Probably our most famous one is Brian Stevenson. Brian came to Eastern, graduated, went to Harvard Law School, and then went south and eventually started what is known as the Equal Justice Initiative in Montgomery, Alabama. I would invite every person who ever hears this particular interview to go down there for what is a life-transforming experience. It was informative, it was painful, it was tear-evoking, and it was motivational and corrective in so many ways. And I speak highly of Brian and his work there. Another graduate of ours is Shane Claiborne. Shane is in his 40s and is a national, international speaker. But when he graduated from Eastern, he and a couple of Eastern alumni started this thing in Philly called The Simple Way. And they ended up purchasing a school bus and equipping it with fax machines at the time and copiers. And they worked with homeless people to get them food, shelter, cleanliness, to teach them how to apply for a job, to be their mailing address, because they had this bus that was registered with a post office box, and they were able to provide, you know, mail service for these clients. So Shane has gone on. He works with the humble and the poor and the outcast. We have a prison education program that is one of the largest in Pennsylvania. We partner with a prison providing 4-credit courses that can lead to an associate's degree and eventually to a bachelor's degree. So coupled with bringing in speakers, motivators, and examples, we also have our students out in these groups. We have a number of student groups that work with the homeless, that work with the incarcerated, that work with hospitals for visitation. And, you know, the thing is, you can't take any of that for granted, because every 4 years, you have a new generation of students, you know, and every year you're changing by 25% at least. So it's not as if we think we have this cornered, because who knows what changes are required in an evolving society. But at this point, that's kind of our modus operandi, that to bring in the kinds of shakers and movers and models that affect faith, reason, and justice, and to get our students out there so that they're shaped by seeing the real needs.
Well, let me talk. Oh, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, we require community service in the first year of study here. It's part of the formation of what it means to be involved with faith, reason, and justice.
Yeah, that was going to be my follow-up question. I was just trying to figure out if that was a requirement or just a great suggestion that you're making to your students. So.
No, we require it. And I forget the actual data, but it's thousands and thousands of hours that are put in that first year. And then what it does is it builds relationships so that a number of students will either continue the interest in one of our student groups that are aligned with that interest, or they will continue in the relationships that they've established in that first year experience.
Yeah. Well, you told me earlier in our conversation that you became the president in 2018. So let me ask you a question about then leadership. Is what's some of your lessons learned since you've stepped into the president role?
Yeah. Well, when I came into the role, I was asked the question, what do you see Eastern addressing in the future? What are your thoughts on Eastern? And I said, well, first of all, if we can be what we say we are, that is an amazing mission. And my experience in 1992 was shaped around coming first as a guest artist and then falling in love with this place and being offered a position. And when I talked to the board about Eastern, I said the shaping experience for me was when I went to my first faculty meeting and I saw how vociferously they argued together. I'd never seen a community argue so well and respectfully and strongly and passionately. But then when the meeting was over, those same people who were in an sympathetic role, they came together, they were talking and smiling. Like you could genuinely oppose one another agreeably. To disagree so well was amazing to me and really shaped one of my appreciations of Eastern. So that was one thing. The second thing that Eastern had to address was that a lot of its identity statements were really thick and dated. So we had like a power graph of language about mission and a paragraph of language about vision. And we had community standards and we had educational values and we had academic protocols. I mean, it was so thick that there is no way anyone would use it for pretty much anything. So in our first three-year strategic plan, that was lesson one. And that's what I told the board. I said, we had to have a complete revision of our vision, mission, and values. Not necessarily the essence of them, but the languaging of them so that they would be pertinent. So, candidly, I'll just quickly review. Our vision statement became what actually was my own vision statement coming into this role that I shared at the inauguration. It's four words: that the Eastern community will listen, love, learn, lead. That's it. That's what we're called to do. And that's an invitational vision. It is aspirational, but it's also invitational. We are in a crisis in communication in the public venue. We yell at each other. We shout. We make false puppets. We lie. We exaggerate in ways that are inappropriate. And then we wonder why our young people are not engaged in politics or they're angry or frustrated. So listen, love, learn, and lead was really appropriate for me in my role. And when the council and the committees that were reviewing all the documents were coming up with it, they really kind of aligned with that particular vision. Our mission is that as an intentionally diverse and Christ-centered institution, we will produce graduates who will impact the world through faith, reason, and justice. That faith, reason, and justice is all over our DNA. And then lastly, it was like, well, how do we live together? And so we just made an acrostic of Eastern of values. So Eastern is excellence. A is authenticity. S is stewardship. T is thoughtfulness. E is enthusiasm. R is relationship. And N is a little bit of a twist, innovation. So we kind of understand that. And that's where we are.
Well, what's your favorite part about being president?
Working with these people, I'm continually overwhelmed by our community. Working with the cabinet, so we have a cabinet, it's four vice presidents. We have then a larger group of about 10 that would be the leadership team. And then we have, of course, the deans of the colleges. And then we have chairs and directors of programs, all the rest. But to see the engagement, we just finished what we call a climate survey. It's different than our cultural audit. Our cultural audit was an external agency, but our climate survey is an internal survey that we do every other year. And this year, we just got the results back from our one that was done earlier this year. And the number of people, this would be all employees, faculty and staff, the number of employees that see their work as directly contributing to the mission of Eastern was 99%. It couldn't be higher. And to have people that are united by the mission and are willing to work, oftentimes sacrificially, not just dedicatedly, has been an inspiration to me. I feel humbled and obligated in the best sense to serve this community to the best I can. And hopefully by doing that we get to serve others outside of Eastern. But it's a great place to work, and I just love our people.
Well, here's my last question. What advice would you give a prospective student when choosing the right college or university for their education?
I think at this point, any school that's surviving probably is probably a pretty good school. So I encourage students to first think about what they have to offer. What do they do individually? What are they looking for to become in their own interests, skills, and goals? Then the second thing is look at the mission of the schools that they might be interested in and see if that mission aligns or connects with what they want to be or become. And then I would say look at the resources to see if the mission and the resources will provide opportunities for students to grow, to fail successfully, to learn about disappointment, problem solving, achievement, and hopefully relationship building. So for me personally, I think it's not that some schools are good and some schools are bad. I think it's really aligning with what kind of community you're investing yourself in for what may be 4 years or more. What kind of skills, relationships, and opportunities will help you give? I find sometimes, for example, we had a student when I was in music who was a violinist, and she transferred from a really great state school. And I said, can I ask why you came to Eastern? Because our music program was not as large as those schools, and we didn't have the resourcing. We had great personal instruction and, you know, good classes. But I just asked her that question, and she said to me, you know, you just had the first chair principal concertmaster of the Philadelphia Orchestra do a master class at Eastern. And I, as a sophomore undergrad, was selected to play and take part in that master class. And she said, at my former school, no one would have gotten that opportunity except the performance majors at the master's or doctoral level. And here I was, a sophomore and undergraduate. You know, sometimes smaller schools can be a better place for access to things that other schools have, but may not have the access to. That's just one example of a school that would be like Eastern, or in this case, Eastern itself, that it's not so much the size as the alignment of opportunity.
Ron, I really appreciate you being on the podcast. I enjoyed our conversation.
Thanks so much. And again, I wish everyone the best. Thanks again.
Thanks, Ron. Well, that ends today's episode. Thanks, everyone, for listening.
Thanks for listening to today's episode. And make sure to visit our website at academicdean.com. Also, if you enjoy our podcast, please don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. Academic Dean is sponsored by Myers-McRae Executive Search and Consulting. Thanks again for tuning in. Until next time.